Man came by to hook up my cable TV. We settled in for the night, my baby and me. We switched round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
This is Peace Talks, a series on nonviolent conflict resolution and peacemaking. I'm Suzanne Kreider. When Bruce Springsteen wrote that song in 1992, 57 channels was the maximum on most cable TV systems. Now you can get 200 channels. With television, radio, newspaper, magazines, video games, and the internet, we're never far from media messages, and many of us spend a lot of time with them. One recent industry survey projected that by the year 2007, most of us will be spending 10 hours a day with some form of the media. Today we'll raise the following questions. What impact does media have on our ability to resolve conflict in our daily lives? Does the proliferation of violence on TV, in movies, and video games reinforce only violent solutions to conflict? Do so-called reality shows help us to resolve conflict in our own real lives? Should media makers take any responsibility for any of this? Today on Peace Talks, the first of a two-part series on media and peacemaking. Part of our program today was recorded at the first annual Media and Consciousness Conference, sponsored by the Institute of Noetic Sciences, in May 2004 in Santa Barbara, California. We assembled a panel that included the Institute's president, James O'Dea, and television producer, Belvy Rooks. And we begin by hearing author and media activist Dwayne Elgin answer the question, what impact do the mainstream media have on either our interest in or our ability to make peace?
I see the mainstream media essentially reinforcing and using violence, both for its advertising and its programming. And there's a common aphorism in the broadcast television industry that says, if it bleeds, it leads. In other words, if there's blood there, we want to show graphic pictures of that. Physiologically, we are conditioned to be oriented towards threat and violence. And so the mainstream media is appealing to our most base instincts, a concern for threat and violence, as a way to hook us into their programming. The violence of the mass media extends, I think, beyond the threat and the reality of showing physical violence into all kinds of other violence. It includes stereotyping racial groups. It includes stereotyping the elderly, stereotyping women. And this is not only an adolescent use of media, it's not only in bad taste, it is really threatening our capacity for mobilizing ourselves as a human family for a sustainable and surpassing future.
Our next panelist is Belvy Rooks. Belvy is a writer, educator, television producer, and the vice president of project development for Carrie Productions. She's also a consultant and producer for a one-hour weekly program called Courage on the Fox Family Channel. This program profiles people who've shown courage and bravery in moments of crisis. Welcome, Belvy.
Thank you.
How do you see the mainstream media impacting our interest in or ability to resolve conflict?
Occasionally, when I'm thinking of relaxing and wanting to watch mainstream television, I find it difficult to find anything that I really want to watch once I establish certain parameters, that I don't want violence, that I don't want to watch, you know, bloodshed, I don't want to... And going to the movies with me is always a challenge with my friends because I don't like watching death and murder and blood as entertainment. I just feel that personally. So, of course, when I'm going to the movies, my eyes are covered a lot, and I'm touching the person next to me and saying, can I look now? And they're totally frustrated. Why do we come to this movie? You know, so I feel that violence sells. And I think one of the things when we look at the studies of the impact of violence on children, by the time a child is 12, they've seen 8,000 murders on television. That, to me, is fairly astonishing in terms of shaping consciousness. So I'm not sure how we can expect that somehow embedded in that message is not violence. And then the other part of this discussion for me is that we're kind of projected in these narrow little niches, that everybody's in a little box and that there's separation. And I think it's hard to kind of identify and have a sense of people's humanity when they are so narrowly niched and you see them as separate from or as other, the good guys and the bad guys and black people and the white people. And, you know, there's, you know, that there's just all of these kind of socially prescribed niches that are dedicated to separation. I think that there isn't an awful lot that builds on questions of peace, but compassion and caring and all of those kinds of things that are, I think, are part of or subtext of what it means to be a peacemaker.
Our third panelist today is James O'Dea, the president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Mr. O'Dea also directed the Washington, D.C. office of Amnesty International for 10 years and has worked on international health and development issues around the world. Welcome, James. How do you see the mainstream media impacting either our interest or ability to make peace?
The impact is inestimable in some ways, and I think we're all at this point beginning to realize that it's probably far, far greater than we imagined. And one of the things that we do at the Institute of Noetic Sciences is try to understand the science of consciousness itself and what sort of mapping you see in relationship to this topic is extraordinary, because the old concept of message sent, message received, message understood in the simple equation of a broadcast formula does not seem to be an adequate description of reality as we now begin to understand it.
Well, what do you see particularly in terms of peacemaking?
With regard to peacemaking itself, peacemaking is something in an interconnected world where if our consciousness really is interlinked in a way that we had not understood before, each one of us is a nodal point of intersection with something, some larger group shared phenomenon. And the old paradigm that somehow history is a series of actors and people in control and we get to watch them as we get to watch the media and that our levels of participation are minimalist is in fact a false paradigm. And if there was a sort of piece of information that you could get out there and say, listen, you are part of the broadcast system. Your own awareness is filtering into the mainstream, that you are a participant in the game. Then you could see in some very fundamental way that you could contribute your own life sourcing and energies into the peace paradigms in the world. And when what is coming at you is a world view that is trying to minimize you and mechanize you into an automated version of a human that is simply a means to have you perform in certain ways, whether perform in certain ways at the ballot box or at the supermarket, that worldview is one that you can fundamentally challenge, and worldviews which we can change and transform as communities.
Institute of Noetic Sciences President James O'Dea, along with television producer Belvy Rooks and author Dwayne Elgin, from our panel at the Media and Consciousness Conference. We'll hear more from that panel in a moment, but to get some more ideas on this question of media influence on conflict resolution skills, we invited to the KUNM studios Leanne Potts, who writes a column on pop culture for the Albuquerque Journal, and Bob McCannon, who directs the New Mexico Media Literacy Project. Bob, does what we see in the media really impact people's ability to resolve conflict nonviolently?
Absolutely. The irony is that the media never tell parents to what extent the research shows the level that watching violence makes kids more aggressive and, more importantly, desensitizes them to the pain and suffering of others. The research on that is just mind-boggling. And it's important to recognize that the Hollywood PR machine criticizes this on the basis of saying, well, it's just correlations. It's just correlations, and correlations don't prove cause and effect. They say that over and over again. You can't prove that watching violence makes kids more aggressive. Well, you can't prove anything with social studies research except through correlations. And the correlations between watching violent media and being aggressive, watching violent media and being desensitized to the suffering of others, is much greater than the correlations between smoking and lung cancer. The bottom line is that that information is not getting out there. Kids are learning to resolve conflict through violence. And I believe it carries over to citizens are thinking in this country that the way to resolve national conflicts is through huge military budgets and through sending those troops off to fight wars where video game kind of weapons are used and come back and they see it on TV.
Leanne, what's your sense about how media impacts people's ability to resolve conflict?
I think you learn conflict resolution skills from many sources. Media is one. It's a powerful one. I think you need to, if you're not making the human connections in your lives, to learn some of this, the fault is with you. I mean, there are other ways to learn your resolution than what Rupert Murdoch tells you or what, you know, a newspaper headline writer tells you or what Dan Rather tells you. I mean, come on. The world's a lot bigger than that.
What motivates people to learn those skills, though, on their own?
Caring about who they are and what their impact is on the world. Caring. If you just want to be entertained and you just want to sit and watch, then no, you're not going to do any better. But, I mean, if you care about making the world a better place, if you want things to be differently, that's what's going to motivate you. If you want to continue to be a very violent nation, and I might add that we've been a violent nation long before there was television, radio, and video games, we were a violent nation. I mean, we have it written in our Constitution, our right to bear guns. You know, we take our weapons real seriously in this culture. I would argue that maybe this culture has never been real good at conflict resolution. Maybe that's a skill we've yet to master.
So, Bob, just prior to the beginning of the war in Iraq in 2003, probably one-third of the American population was anti-war. Did we see that representation in coverage in the media?
No, I think the research shows pretty clearly that that the news programming since 9/11, leading up to the war in Iraq, featured almost entirely retired generals and people who were associated with the military establishment, and it was, I mean, an incredible number, like 500 to 5 of those of the experts, 500 basically pro-war people, compared to 5 people who might have been anti-war. I don't remember the exact figures. I think more importantly, the key thing here is that the war in Iraq was very much an extension of the action movie video game culture. There's no doubt in my mind that people saw that war very much as being like an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or being like a first-person shooter game. And those kinds of correlations, I think, led to a great deal of the popularity of the war. One of the reasons the war right now has dropped off in popularity with young people is because it's no longer like a video game. Now we're starting to see, for the first time, more casualties, and we're starting to see more of the damage to not only American forces but Iraqi people as well.
And we're in the dues-paying phase of that whole march to war. I mean, you're even seeing major newspapers like the New York Times and the Baltimore Sun back off and say, we got snookered in the way we reported, you know, the information that led us into this war, which is just stunning to have major newspapers come out and say that. So I know what you're getting about conflict resolution, but you're hearing a lot of mea culpas out there.
In addition to the war, you know, a lot of surveys suggest that TV news, for example, really focuses on crime stories, and they won't cover other stories unless there's some kind of conflict or some kind of violent scene. Does that kind of policy have some tangible effect on our understanding of how conflict can be resolved?
I don't work in TV news. I work for its rival print, so I should put that out there before I bash them. But TV news runs very, very heavily on ratings, and they have to be entertaining. That's why they run so much about crime. I mean, it's entertaining. People want to hear about that stuff. And, you know, the things about, you know, Peace March or a wonky story about someone telling you why the war was a bad idea, just, you know, it's not really entertaining.
Well, how do you think print is doing?
They could do better. We do better than TV because we have more space. I mean, they've got to fit everything in, what, 17 minutes? They've got of airtime. We at least have a little more space. We're doing better than TV, but probably not as good as we could.
How do you think print media could do a better job in terms of educating folks on conflict resolution?
Cover more groups that work to alleviate these kind of things. You know, domestic abuse groups, child abuse groups. There's a lot of education groups out there. You know, put a little bit more money into the social beat. Have a reporter who covers this stuff and talks about these groups to educate people about how to, you know, navigate conflict. Again, these are unsexy stories. They're not going to be on, out front, you know.
One of the things that I think that the print media could do would be to point out the difference between print media and television media. It always amazes me that the print media never points out that when you're reading, it's happening in a different part of your brain. It's happening in a more analytical part of your brain. You have a layer of symbol system interpretation between you and the violence, and that when you're watching violence on TV, that it's happening in the oldest and most powerful part of the brain. And therefore, you know, not only are print media much more informative than the televised media, but they also don't have as direct and powerful an impact upon people in terms of their aggressive nature and their appreciation of aggression. And I think that print media ought to do more to publicize that fact.
Do we run a disclaimer that says this is not a TV? How do we?
Oh, I think
it just seems so obvious to me. Of course we're not television.
Well, I talk to 50,000 people a year all over the country, and I will guarantee you that most people don't know that.
That a newspaper is not a isn't a television broadcast?
That a newspaper is much different than a broadcast in the way people perceive it and process it neurologically. And the effect that it has upon them and their children is much different.
Bob McCannon of the New Mexico Media Literacy Project in conversation with Albuquerque Journal columnist Leanne Potts. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and you're listening to Peace Talks, a series that explores peacemaking efforts and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies. Today we're hearing the first of a two-part program exploring the role the media might play in shaping our attitudes and abilities related to dealing with conflict. Some of our content today was recorded during a panel discussion at the Media and Consciousness Conference in May 2004 that included author and activist Duane Elgin, James O'Dea, president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and television producer Belvy Rooks. Let me ask the whole panel, though, because I hear media professionals say, well, we're just giving people what they want. They wouldn't be watching, listening, or reading unless they wanted to see violence. How do you all respond to that?
Well, one thing that doesn't take into account, I did, you know, a couple of years ago produce a program for Fox Family. But one of the things that program attempted to do was to provide examples of ordinary people doing extraordinary things, extraordinarily kind things, compassionate things. And the pilot that we did, we were able to get 6 million people, you know, weekly watching it, which doubled what had been the viewing audience during that time prior to the show. But also we were up against Survivor, and that was 40 million people. So 6 million people, which we were excited about, didn't seem particularly impressive to advertisers. The paradox and the point I'm making is that one of the things that kind of marketing view doesn't take into consideration are the number of people who've turned off the television. And so part of what I found myself in the paradox of was producing for people who no longer watched. And that people would say to me, if there was more like this on television, I would watch. So there is this thing about, well, we're giving them what they want, but who is the they? There are hundreds and thousands and millions of people who have actually disconnected, and I would use the same analogy as voting, that people who sometimes are not participating as voters, it's not, I find, out of apathy. It's that they have disconnected and said kind of pox on everybody's house, and so I'm not participating, and my passive resistance is nonetheless an active resistance. And I would argue that that same kind of dynamic exists within television, that and our challenge is how to reach those people.
Dwayne Elgin.
I want to affirm what Belvey was saying, that there's a huge number of people that have essentially turned off of the mainstream media because it isn't serving their more mature interests. And I agree that programs like Survivor do draw on our more adolescent interests. I do want to speak to the issue, are we really getting what we want? And I think a very important case study is the experience of ABC Television when they almost gave up Ted Koppel and his program Nightline in favor of David Letterman. And it turns out there were far more people that were actually watching Nightline than David Letterman, but nonetheless they wanted to replace Nightline with Letterman because the people watching David Letterman were of a demographic segment. They were younger, they were more affluent, they were more appealing to advertisers. And there are a number of examples like that that indicate we're not really getting what we want, we're getting what the advertisers want and we will tolerate. And if there's a program, let's say, about, let's say, peacemaking in the world and looking at the roots of terrorism and poverty, for example. There are a number of SUV manufacturers that will just decline to put their ads on that kind of program, or a hamburger producer and such. They'll say, well, that's not quite right for us. So what we're seeing is a conflict between the advertising community and its values and the programming needed to sustain and support this new world. And we're in this very awkward transitional time. But I think we can move towards a media system that will actually give us what we want, but that requires citizens to stand up and give feedback.
James, you've said that the media seems increasingly preoccupied with being a recorder of evolutionary error rather than a recorder of evolutionary shift and emergence. But are you actually asking the media to change human nature, to have us be more interested in peacemaking and wisdom practices and consciousness?
Yes, we were talking a moment ago about the reality shows, and that's such a wonderful mischaracterization of the word reality. I was in Chicago for a talk, and I saw on the front page of several newspapers in Chicago the face of the person who had won in the Donald Trump show, reality show, so-called. Well, in this reality show, Mr. Trump not only gets to manifest and demonstrate, you know, crude capitalist arrogance and ruthlessness, he also, in the reality, gets to promote his products and his new business enterprises. And so to me, it is a graphic example of the media saying, this is what it looks like at the end of this particular form of consciousness. You know, it is its own documentary of what Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine was saying earlier in our conference, of a dying paradigm, of a dying meaning system. That is something that, you know, as we've talked about in this conference, we have to be careful for. People are using the word media trauma and damage to our health, because it's like a force of entropy that if you wish to go with it, it will pull you down into its own form of collapsing meaning.
But isn't that part of the challenge? People want to be lulled into passivity. They want to rest. So it sounds like what you're trying to create in terms of this shift, we would actually need to develop a desire for people to be awake.
Yes, beautifully said. A desire to live and to be and to create and to feel that you are a participant in the real reality show. Isn't that an extraordinary thing, that people might actually want that? And the answer is yes. That's the real evolutionary news, that people will want that, and the other will dissolve into its own form of reality.
That was James O'Dea, president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. The reality show genre has given us hugely popular programs like Survivor, The Apprentice, and Eliminate. They're all based on the premise that if you can't get along with somebody, they can just be sent away rather than dealt with. Albuquerque Journal columnist Leanne Potts had more comments about the impact these shows might have on our real-life ability to resolve conflict.
Interesting thing about reality TV is it's about our fantasies. I mean, the whole reason the whole Donald Trump thing was so popular, I think, is all of us work with people we'd love to just see get fired and tossed out of our lives. So stop stressing us out, but it's not going to happen. We're going to have to go back in and deal with them the next day. So it's fun to sit home at night on TV and watch that happen in fantasy, you know. It's a fantasy. That's the irony of reality TV. It taps into our fantasies and shows you this unscripted version of it that's contained and canned and kind of has an ending done. But I don't think people are watching that thinking, let me get some tips on how I should act at the office.
Bob McCannon?
Well, once again, I believe that that's a little bit of an either-or kind of attitude. If you look at the whole idea of fantasy and satire versus people's perception of reality, what you find is that, well, the show that was probably most thoroughly researched was All in the Family. Now, All in the Family designed Archie Bunker to be a satire of a bigot. And he went through life resolving his problems by spouting all kinds of bigotry against various ethnic groups. Now, when they did surveys, they found out about 72% of the audience knew that. Now, for most of those people, they probably got a message that caused them to think more seriously about tolerance and less seriously about acting in a bigoted fashion. But the 28% actually thought Archie Bunker was a hero. So they indeed were absorbing the fantasy as reality. And I think that the same thing applies to these reality TV shows. You can't say that it was just a fantasy and write it off. I think for some people, it does act as a way to reinforce negative ways of problem solving and or mediation.
If you think you should get tips on how to behave from a reality TV show, you've got far, far bigger problems than your TV set and what you're getting there and what Fox is showing you. That's just crazy. You can't make Fox TV or Donald Trump or the producers of any of these shows responsible for the segment of the population that's that clueless.
Well, that's easy to say, except that on the way back from San Diego last week, I sat next to two charming young college graduates. They just graduated from San Diego State University, and they had their Sean Hannity book, both of them. They had just gotten married, and each one of them had their Sean Hannity book. I talked to them for quite a while, and it was very clear to me that they thought that Rush Limbaugh and Fox TV were the greatest purveyor of their own personal value system, and they were college graduates.
Doesn't surprise me.
Leanne Potts of the Albuquerque Journal and Bob McCannon of the New Mexico Media Literacy Project. As we've looked at media's connection to our appreciation of nonviolent conflict resolution, we've tried to describe the existing landscape on this first program. Next time on Peace Talks, July 30th at 8 a.m., part two on this topic, we'll continue our conversation with our guests and ask if the media could make compelling content that might deepen our ability to resolve conflict nonviolently. We'll also explore what media consumers can do to promote change in what they're exposed to. You can hear this program again and find other resources on this topic at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. You can hear other programs in our series there as well. Peace Talks is produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated with help from KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls. Music by Bruce Springsteen and Allie Adelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.